Welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcast, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms, through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community.
Good evening, good morning, good night, good second breakfast, whenever you are, wherever you are. My name is Laura Gonzalez, and I welcome you to Lunatic Mondays on CSMP, the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast. Tonight, we have an author that I'm dying to dive into their brain. Her name is Jenna Tellendrew. I knew I was going to butcher that. She's from New York. She holds a master's in Celtic studies from the University of Wales, Trinity State St. David, and has a bachelor's degree in archaeology. She founded the Sisterhood of Avalon in 1995 and serves as the academic dean of the Avalonian Theological Seminary. Jenna hosts residential training retreats around North America and the UK, presents internationally at conferences and festivals, teaches online workshops and immersion programs, and facilitates pilgrimages to sacred sites in the British Isles and Ireland through the Mythic Seeker Tours. A priestess in the Avalonian tradition for almost 35 years, Jenna has been following a pagan path, since 1986. You can learn more about her work on www.ynysafallon.com. and www.sisterhoodofavalon.org. And I needed to spell that because I have no idea what that spells. Welcome, Jenna, to the show. Thank you for accepting coming to Lunatic Mondays. How are you?
Thank you for having me, Laura. And I apologize for making that so difficult. All of the Welsh words are very difficult, believe me. I understand.
Next time, I'm going to ask you to read the name of the Aztec gods and goddesses. And
I won't be able to do even. That.
Welcome to the show. How are you today? And it's our first time meeting in person, so I'm very happy to have you on the show. How's it going? Since you have, this book out is so fantastic.
Oh, thank you. It's going really well. It's been busy time. You know, the beginning of the year is always setting up, you know, things to come and a lot of things for the Sisterhood of Avalon. We just had our Women in Druidry conference and setting up our schedule for things. So it's been a busy time. But like you said before we started, kind of enjoying that scary winter where it's 50 degrees and, you know, it's not right, not living where we do.
Scary good weather, I call it. And
scary
it is
good weather.
Yeah, it's good because it feels good. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm wearing short sleeves, but it is really mm-hmm. not the best thing that is happening to our earth. Mm-hmm. And speaking of earth and goddess, obviously, I heard it say by somebody not too long ago, the origin story. So, Jenna, for people that don't know you, what is your origin story? How did you get into paganism and more particularly the goddess path?
So I was bitten by a radioactive Greek mythology book when I was in elementary school. And that's it. When I was young, I loved mythology. I remember wishing I lived in the past so that I could worship, you know, Artemis and Athena. And it wasn't until, I was 16 that I discovered through the women's spirituality book by Diane Stein that there were people here and now and today who were worshiping the goddess. And before I just thought it was, you know, wow, that would have been nice. So it was very exciting. I am an older person. So we didn't, you know, this is in the age before the internet, back in 1986. So I was born and raised in New York City. There was pagan and witch communities there. I was able to connect. So I joined a coven when I was 18. It was a Gardnerian kind of offshoot. And but yeah, but I've always loved the Celtic mythos. I loved Arthurian tradition as a very precocious reader. And so when I found The Mists of Avalon, it actually found me because it came in the mail. I was in one of those book clubs where you're supposed to mark the X and send the thing back, or you get it automatically. Well, I didn't do that. And so it arrived, this giant hardcover book, and I was like, I got this. I was 13 and I loved it. And so and I'd been reading tons of Arthurian stuff too. So it was just kismet. And yeah, so that is really what got me started down the path. And I didn't look back.
That is a wonderful story because I think in retrospect, you can say the goddess sent it to you, right? The book. Like she's like, okay, you're one of mine. Here's the book.
Here's the book. And that book is so, I mean, you know, there are a lot of, we know a lot of problematic things about Marin Zimmer Bradley now.
Yes, we know that.
So yeah, so there's that sadness. But I think a lot of people, you know, who came into goddess spirituality or paganism, witchcraft, Wicca in my, you know, generation, that book was kind of like the portal of entry. Again, there was no internet. So even if they weren't doing Avalon things, they were certainly, you know, goddess worship came to the forefront at that time. So it was very, very influential. So a lot of sadness around all of
Yeah.
that and not so good stuff.
They say never meet your heroes, right? And that's kind of one of those moments where we cannot undo the things that some of our elders have done or said, and we can only do better because we know better
That's
and
right.
move forward and pick up the mantle and continue. And I think by recognition, I love your book, and I love I cannot not do it. My dear friend and mentor, I've been studying under him a number of times, Christopher Hughes, writes, "A rich tapestry of history, fine scholarship, and the weaving of folklore, story, archaeology, and vision." This was written by Christopher Hughes, head of the Anglesey Druid Order and bestselling author, of course, part of the Llewellyn family and others. And so, for a lot of women and people that practice on the goddess tradition, the goddess religion, the goddess spirituality, the goddess philosophy, they interchange a lot of names and titles and work orders. Some call themselves witches, some call themselves priestess, some call themselves practitioners. Where you stand on that? What are you?
I consider myself a priestess, and in my opinion, a priestess is not, it's something that you do, it's an action, it's you know, how you move through the world, it's how you're in service, and there are a lot of ways of being in service. So
Absolutely. Yeah. And so you that book came to your hands. You start learning about now the goddess in Avalon. You've already known of Athena and all the Greeks and the traditional pagan. How do you actually start the practice, your personal practice?
I was studying archaeology in undergrad, and my mentor was actually from Oxford, and she was really wonderful and allowed me to go in my senior year to Glastonbury to on a trip. I was in a women's circle, and what brought us together was Avalon. But what so it was exciting for me because even then I was like, oh, I had no idea that there was a place that you could point to that had these associations. So it really kind of started me down the path of what's myth? What's history? What's legend? How do those intertwine? You know, so yeah, so that was exciting for me. And again, that was in undergrad. And then, but what I did find is that there was a lot that I was learning and that I was practicing and that, you know, was being taught that it didn't actually line up a lot with, you know, what I understood and was learning about Celtic cultures and Celtic belief systems. And so when I after I graduated, I started to deconstruct these things and continue to research and learned about that's about when the time the internet kind of came about. So in 1994 I first got online and all of these resources opened to me. And this is when I learned about Celtic Reconstructionism. So a very solid, you know, I started with Dianic Wicca into this kind of Celtic women's Avalon centered thing, and then learning about this praxis that people were doing where they were trying to reconstruct and be very culturally specific and respectful and honoring. And so that's the path that took me down. So I always feel like I have a foot in both paths, right? There is this foundation of the women's spirituality movement, which was very empowering and but maybe not always as centered in scholarship as perhaps the more Celtic side was able to be. But not that, but the thing that I always come to is this: are people growing? Are they transforming? Is it making a positive impact on their lives? Are they in relationship with Goddess? And if that happens through things that feel right, as opposed to things that are culturally accurate, in the end, it's you and the Goddess at your altar. That's what's important. I see, because I did do my master's degree at the University of Wales and wanted to learn about Welsh culture from Welsh people. And what I found was that the scholarship deepened my practice. It gave me more ways in, which was very exciting to me. And I think that it's just one way of building a bridge to connection. There are other ways, and this way is not the way for everybody. But I do feel that since I'm working in a tradition that is Welsh based, and I'm not Welsh, I'm not of Welsh heritage, I don't live in Wales, I have a responsibility to present things in as culturally accurate and reflective as possible, to say, this is what we know. Here's a way of looking at it. And this is how we can take that and move forward into practice with it in a way that is honoring and respectful and founded in tradition. So I think that's a different thing than I think the goddess, I don't know when you came into goddess spirituality. The goddess movement was very, it was very kind of flowy and very body centered and very reclamation and political and emotional and healing and just beautiful in that way. And that's that, and I think that's another way into relationship. So there's
I was found by the goddess in 2009, and I'm definitely still into the very political, very empowering, very both academic and also I always forget this UPG on verified personal gnosis, you know. I don't do the body kumbaya, let's all paint with our blood and blah blah. That's just not me. And I think we are all our choices are always permeated by our experiences, right? Me as an indigenous woman, immigrant, I still don't understand how I am an immigrant in our continent, but that's another conversation for another day. Immigrant on the United States, big air quotes, disabled, fat, vegan, queer, indigenous, Mexican, you know, all of the different traverses, things on feminism, intersections. I always forget this word. Obviously the goddess for me is an icon of liberation and empowerment and power with, not power over, and very political, very, very political. As a matter of fact, I started on January teaching a course called Decolonizing the Goddess, bringing our goddess power or goddess energy to our goddesses here in America. And when I say America, you all know I'm talking about a continent, not a country. Country's name is the United States. Here in America, we have plenty of goddesses. I don't know all of them, but I'm familiar with the ones from my tribes, from my people. So that's what I'm bringing to people. And my head was bobbing so much for those who are not watching the video. When you were saying, like, if I am practicing Welsh traditions, Welsh culture, I ought to go to Wales and learn from the Welsh. The same applies for all this Mexica, so-called Aztec, or any other diaspora or indigenous cultures that can and should, in my opinion, blend with the goddess culture, because we do have our own goddess culture that should never be ignored or put down as a second best. The more goddesses, the better. So,
That's right.
and there are some icons from the Mexican culture that have been included in, particularly like Dianic, they have the Virgin of Guadalupe and this icon that is truly the mother of America. We used to say Latin America, but there's so many of us beyond Latin America that she's everywhere. And my goal is to still go behind that colonization. Who sits under the veil of the Virgin, and that is Coatlicue and other goddesses. So it is really important for me that what you mentioned about going to the source, going to the person that has lived the experience, going to the folk knowledge, right? And not only basing on academia, which what we were talking about right before we started the recording. Full disclosure, I asked Jenna about this matrilineal, matrifocal cultures, and we both mentioned immediately the work of Marija Gimbutas, or I know I butchered her name too, please I apologize. Why is it so important that we recognize these academic bodies of work that have been done before, that have been dismissed?
Well, first, I just want to say that I honor you and the work that you're doing. I think it's so important. I know that having been in the paganism for more than 40 years at this point, and acknowledging its Eurocentricity and how it pulls from so many different cultures, chakras and, all kinds of, that decolonizing these practices is so important. And that I just thank you. I just want to, honor the work that you're doing. It's so important, and to bring these other divinities into the forefront.
And I don't know that anybody else has done this work, not at least not on the Anglo community. And I think it's important because people are running rampant with images and icons and things and concepts that they really don't understand. So we need to go to the source. And I happen to be Mexican from Mexico. I'm not Mexican American. I'm Mexican from Mexico. I grew up in Mexico. So, but thank you. The show is not about me. Tell us your take on academia that is has been dismissed.
Well, I think there are a couple of things. I mean, I have found, and perhaps because I'm during European studies, that it's been illuminating for me to see the things that I'm interested in with the Celtic culture, how these things have been studied, for over a century of academic work in there. Even though that has its own problems, but all of that to say, yes, I think that academia has its blind spots, it has its biases, it has these filters that it looks at things through. And certainly, in the 1960s, a lot of those Eurocentric, it's like social Darwinism kind of shifts started to happen, and with cultural studies particularly. So things began to change, but I still think that there is this patriarchal mindset that underscores just the entire system of academia. And so the ways in which Gumbadas, and I guess I'm saying her name wrong, which, forgive me, can you? No, yeah, I'm not sure.
I heard it as Jimbutas. That's
Gumbutas,
how I
well,
say it. I don't know.
so her work was, I mean, I was studying archaeology. I have all of her books in hardcover. I mean, I love the work that she did. The fact that in recent years, people have been, kind of deconstructing her work and evaluating it and dismissing some of it. And, I think all academics, all areas of study need to have these critical lenses put upon them. I mean, that's how we grow, that's how we, shift it, that's how, things proceed. But I think that a lot of the pieces that have been levied are a reflection of this male-centered, Eurocentered lens that academia uses to evaluate things. And so to think about different ways of knowing, of different ways of, different concepts of of approaching the materials, because you have material, and then you have, which is, what it is, what it is. But then how we interpret it, that's where the biases come in. So yes, that is, I think that is definitely the case when it comes to these things.
And we happen the same things post-contact, post-colonialism, and particularly in Mexico, where all the little figurines and all the little statuettes of goddesses were all cataloged as wife of, priestess of, mother of, sister of, lover, daughter. She never, she was never able to stand on herself because by their male gaze, male biases, there was no room for a woman of power. And we still are, 500 years later, we're still fighting for the ability to goddess have autonomy of our own bodies. I never thought, living in the United States, that we have less rights than third world, so-called third world countries. But that is, and that is all the body of the goddess. That is all the goddess work and goddess structure. And we need, quoting the one Phyllis quote, the world needs her witches, and we need our priestesses, and we need to continue having these hard conversations about the divinity of women and people and the body and autonomy and joy and love and, all of the other things that we've been stripped of because of this rampant illness called patriarchy.
I agree. And I think, if I may,
Course.
I think it ties into this idea that, how women are treated in a society, when we're commodified, when, we're there's an ownership kind of a situation, it's a reflection of how we treat all res we're a resource, just like any other resource to be exploited, right? How can we profit? What do we bring that will, and so our status is a reflection of the status of how the planet is being treated. And so it is a political act. It is as we go for our own freedom, it's an act of rebellion for the planet as well.
Yeah, because she's Gaia. If she was Gaio, it would be different.
She was just a guy.
A Gaia. But yeah, that's one of the workshops that I teach, like we treat the earth as we treat our mother, and unfortunately, it's not very conscientious, let's put it that way. Choosing a very mild word,
Yes.
So,
And if I may, I mean, there's a
yeah,
reflection of
please.
this in Celtic traditions and Arthurian traditions with the sovereignty figure. The sovereignty figure who empowers the ruler of the land, of the territory, of the tribe, of the nation. It is an intermediary between this world and the other world. And when the king or the ruler is in right relationship, the land is bountiful and the waters flow. But when he is not in right relationship, when he is lawless, when he is, exploitive of his people, when he's cruel, she withdraws her blessing, and then the world falls in, or the land falls into the wasteland. And that is the under story that from the Grail myth that comes over. The king and the land are one, and the wasteland is restored when the balance is returned. And so that is where we are. We're heading towards the wasteland, and we need to bring in this balance. We need to be in right relationship
Yeah.
with our mother, with goddess, with our earth. Otherwise, she'll shake us off.
Yeah. And we're women and girls and trans women and transgender people and all the people, and and I wish we were all understanding that more rights for everybody don't mean less rights for one particular group of people. But let's not get too political like we haven't. Let's talk about this. Magnificent. Let me see how many pages. Almost 500 pages.
It's a chonker.
Of the Ninefold Way of Avalon, your beautiful baby. I'm very, very fortunate that Llewellyn sends me, they throw box of me here and there. And I was so nervous about the Ninefold of Avalon because I am a very slow reader, ESL. And also, I come from oral tradition, so this is my media. Reading is like a little challenging, whether English or Spanish. And I am so glad I broke through my fears and said, I want her on the show. I want the book. The publishing team,
Yes, Marcus is amazing.
Marcus is the best. If you don't know who I'm talking about, you gotta look at the Luella website, look at Marcus, then you know who he is. This is a beautiful work of art, and I am one person, as I was saying, going culturally from oral tradition and the folk and the practices and the people and the land and all the things that have been destroyed by colonization, and then we trying to recover, not to reconstruct, but to understand and to recover. And then I find this book. I have a bone to chew with academia, as you might notice already. And then I find your book, and the first thing you say on this book is like, is academic, but it's also historic, folkloric, archaeological. You found the formula, I don't know how, to marry all the things. And also to say, and sometimes we don't know. And sometimes we're not gonna know. And it is what it is, and we're just gonna move forward. Now, this is the silliest question of them all. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, so I've been calling this my mullet book. It's got the academia in the front and the woo-woo in the back. So, and there's something for everyone. If you like practice, you've got that. If you like the, if you're not into that, this kind of work, but you want, so this is the thing. This is the book that I wish I had when I started down the Avalon path. My intention here was to bring together, what do we actually know about Avalon? What are the written records? How far back does it go? But again, you mentioned oral tradition, and that's the thing about the Celts is that, we have in Welsh tradition, for example, the bardic stories,
Yeah.
that and it was a cornerstone of their culture. They were the keepers of culture. They were the rememberers of history and lineage and tale and myth. And so the stories that we have stayed in orality for hundreds and hundreds of years between when the Britons were pagan and and when they were written down in the early medieval period when they were Christian. And so in the time that they were in, it was an oral tradition, the stories changed and they grew. And these were natural reflections of the shifts in culture. And so I think it's important for us to keep that in mind, that they're not broken stories. There are stories that reflect the cultural needs of any time. And that's the beauty of oral tradition. It's living tradition. And so I talk about this idea of the stream of tradition. And it says that there are pieces that come from pagan, pre-Christian. There are elements of it that we can look at other cultures, Irish and even other Indo-European cultures, and pull that piece out. There are historical records that talk about, and the Romans talk about these islands of priestesses off the coast of France. These are Gaulish, so Celtic priestesses who lived in enclaves, nine women. And there are a lot of historical pieces about nine women that show up in myth and in history. In a lot of these Indo-European derived cultures. And then there is the symbol sets that come with all of that. So there is lore and there is history. And then there is the piece where we know that, the roles that women played, holy women, in the pre-Christian and the post-Christian cultures. They were saints, they were priestesses, they were healers, they were seers, they were diplomats, they were involved with Druidism, they were the, they held high status, they were learned, they were poets and seers. And so what do we actually know about them? So to take all of those things, those three main streams of tradition that inform the Avalon that we have received today. So we can't say the Avalon was in Glastonbury or was in this place or in that place. There are a lot of places that are like Avalon. Glastonbury became associated with Avalon in the 1100s, and it's stuck. And so it's a place where you can go. It's a powerful place anyway. I don't if you've ever been, or I mean, it's just it is an incredible place, very transformational. The land itself is powerful, and that story has lived there for over 1,000 years, and so it's easy to connect there. But I really do think that Avalon, in truth, never had a particular place, that it is solidly in the other world, and that there are ways that we can connect to her. And myth tells us how. There are mythic maps that show us how to get there. And so that is the piece, to be honest about what we know, to not dismiss things out of hand because they come from Christian period, because they are medieval writings, because it only comes from literature or story. Because I think that's a mistake that a lot of people make. And this is where I think the fact that I was lucky enough to be able to train academically in this is to understand that story is not just about, or legends, lore, myth. It's not just about whether or not a story actually took place. That is its power. It is also, there are pieces of culture that are preserved in tale. Even if the story itself never literally happened, the structure of the society is a reflection of the culture at the time. The belief system, what they thought about the world around them, how they interacted with the spirits and the lands. The other world is very, very prominent in Welsh tradition. So there are ways of looking at story. There are ways of tracing symbol sets back that is illuminating. So it doesn't need to have been, we're never going to find the truth, but it doesn't mean that what is in these stories isn't true. There is so much information we can glean from it. And these pieces open us to the Awen, open us to divine inspiration, allow us to build a bridge of connection. And that is the place to start. And then where it grows from there is the work that we're doing now. Oral tradition is living tradition. And so if we tie into what was, right, understand it, really look at it, be in that flow, then the work that we do coming after within those things is part of the flow. We're moving it along. It's not supposed to be static. It's supposed to grow with us. And so I think in order for it to be a part of what was, we have to know what came before. And so I tried to do that so people didn't have to go and pull all these things and do all of this research. I tried to put it here in a way that was accessible and that the practice in the back of the mullet is founded on that. It's using those symbol sets. It's using those insights. It's using those mythic maps. So not everyone's a scholar. Like you said, not everybody likes to read, and there's nothing, inherently wrong with that. It's not, or, learning disabilities, or, ESL, things like that, or it's just not your preference. And
Different ways of learning. And
that's
I
right.
think the important thing is, what is myth? And myth is what we create, the stories that we create in order to understand the world around us, right?
That's
Because
right.
in the Mexica culture, whale is a hummingbird and the hummingbird is whale. And that doesn't mean we Mexicas have a hummingbird in our chest. It's a metaphor.
That's
It's an
right.
allegory. It's a way to explain things that we don't have the language to explain. And it has been like that for millennia until the Phoenicians, I think, started writing things down, or the I can't remember, the first people who started writing,
The
the
Sumerians.
Sumerians, thank you. And then writing came about. And now, in the age of information, we kind of want to pick the bone that if it is not written, it's not right. Kind of like people say colloquially, a photo or it didn't happen. Well, there was no photos back then. There was no way to preserve the knowledge other by through singing, through dancing, through metaphors, through stories. Because if I tell you 2 plus 2 is 4, you are going to get it. But if I tell you I have 2 apples and I have 2 oranges, how much fruit do I have? That's how we teach children, is through storytelling. And I think academia is fantastic to have a record keeping of things that need to be kept records, right? Like podcasts and video. And it changes with the time and it changes with the needs of the people.
right.
and the ingenuity of humanity, but forgetting our creativity or dismissing our creativity, I don't think, and particularly for earth-based spirituality religions, it's like it's a paradox that just doesn't fly. And I love the, like you said, I love the mullet. You made me laugh. Because it is exactly, I mean, I'm so glad that you came up with that concept, because it is true. You put the academia first, you put all the research first, and then on the back is the praxis. And I love that the book has been structured that way, because in order for a person to learn what they do, in my opinion, learning why we're doing it that way is vital. At one point in my life, was at a circle where a chant was chanted in a different language, neither English nor Spanish. And everybody was chanting, just repeating. And I'm like, wait a minute, what are we saying? Like, I don't want to just go through the motions of repeating a chant without knowing what I'm putting my energy towards. So it is really important in this walk in the path of the priestess that we know the whys, the who, the when, and the how. What is the technology behind it? Because if you don't give this technology, these reasons, then we're falling on the same, in my opinion, mistakes that are done with the larger, more common religions that people blindly
just by rote
follow.
Yeah.
And piggybacking on that, don't hate on Christian records. Don't hate on Catholic, you know, they are our best record keeping people. A lot of the Mexica culture that we have recorded is because after they genocide, they're like, oh, wait a minute, there was something here. What was it? And then they try to record. So it's thanks to them.
That's right.
As much as we dislike, in my case, being Mexica, the codices. As much as we dislike that they were written by Freys and priests, they conserve the knowledge.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think in Celtic traditions, a lot of people think, oh, it was written in the medieval period by some monks. And the reason why the goddess, like Arianrhod, is this, you know, she's un, like, what's her problem anyway? Like, you know, she's just mean and she's bitchy. And why is she like that? It must be because the monks made her that way so people wouldn't worship her. But, you know, there are different stories that kind of have that piece, especially in Ireland, and hagiographies are meant to say, I'm the saint that overcame the king of the fairies. I mean, it's meant to say Christianity is stronger than paganism, but that's not what's going on with the Mabinogi, with a lot of the Welsh pieces, because nobody was there saying, oh, I'm going to do this. What happened is that the story stayed in morality. It shifted over time. The things that these figures represented shifted and sometimes stayed the same. And so when it was written down, it was to preserve Welsh culture. So it was intended to be written down as it was. And in the Mabinogi specifically, which is those are the stories and some other tales in that time period, that is the main mythic stories in Welsh tradition. It was written down at a time when Wales had lost its independence and they were trying to preserve their culture. So those stories seem to have been written as if there was a bard, because it seemed like some of them, there were phrases in it that, you know, looked like it was being recited. And so they just wrote what they heard. So, you know, there's more to it than that. It's not just some evil, you know, Christians trying to hate on the things. But there's another thing I wanted to say, if you don't mind. There's something that you said about having the language, you know, expressing things with the language that we have. And that, to me, is a really beautiful reflection of what this ninefold path of the priestess is about. Because not everyone needs to be, or wants to be, or is drawn to be a scholar, right? What we need to do is to find our right work in the world, our vocation, the thing that burns in our heart, you know, to go where the awen, the divine inspiration, flows. And there are many ways of priestess service. And you can understand the mysteries of the universe, come into connection with the goddess when you're observing things through the filter, through the lens of your passion. If you're an artist, you understand the language of color and form and shape, and you can understand the way the universe works in that way. If you're a physicist, you understand the ways in which, you know, photons move and, you know, these cosmic principles that the universe runs on, and you understand, the cosmic piece in that, whether it's dance or physiology or, sociology, if you're an activist, or, how to build communities, how, all of these things speak to us in the language that we know. So it's important for us, I think, no matter what it is, to find a devotional path, to become immersed in it in some way, find that passion. Feed the flame of it. And it doesn't matter. Being a priestess isn't always just about being the ritualist or the seer or the, it is about all so many different ways of being in service, to be in connection. Find the thing that brings you joy and allow the divine to speak to you through it, whether it's metaphor, whether it's language of the flowers or the principles of herbalism or the movements of animals. All of these things reflect the same universal truths. So find that language and tie into it. You don't have to. We're about sovereignty in our tradition. It's about finding who you are and becoming who you're meant to be, a whole person with your own agency in the world. And so it doesn't make sense to be a priestess that to be a priestess, you must do this and this and this and this and this only. Yes, I think training is important. I think you need to learn principles. I think you need to know the technology. Wonderfully said. And then once you have all of that, then you move forward in a way that is true to who you are, that is a reflection of your work in the world.
Yeah.
So I just
How
went
are you
on a
gonna
tear there, but I appreciate that you said that.
how are you gonna serve the greater good by not deserving yourself, finding your true path? And I tell my apprentices or and whoever else wanna listen to my crazy things, each witch has their niche.
Each
You
witch.
cannot
Love it.
have a witch, or in this case, a priestess. And if people are not comfortable with using those interchangeable, that's fine. Please know I am at this moment using it. Not mean to offend anybody. If you prefer to be called a priestess, then that's you. I like to be called a witch, and I think it's the same. What is the vocation and action towards your community? And it's not a title that you wear, but it's an action that you share with your community. And with
We
that
look at,
said,
oh, sorry.
I'm sorry, and with that said, not everybody is a seer, not everybody is a ritualist, like you said, and I think particularly like younger generations, they go to one extreme or the other. They're like, oh, you have to do everything and you have to do it right and you have to have 3 years or 7 years or 9 years or whatever, which is important to have a formation, but there is a limit on the time. We cannot be a student all the time, though continued growth and learning is good. But then you have this like, watch my TikTok in 15 minutes, you're a priestess. So there are two extremes that I think bridging that gap and bringing it to the middle, like you don't have to be all the things, but also you cannot be it in 10 minutes. There
That's
is
right.
formation, there is work, and more than anything, I was going to say in Spanish, sobre todo, and more than anything, to understand where your calling lies and how you're going to share those gifts with your community. Because it's a job title.
That's right.
It's not a chip on your shoulder.
That's right. And if I may say, part of our approach in the Avalonian tradition and the Sisterhood of Avalon is we take things on three levels. We engage in service to self, which is not self-serving, but it's who am I? What is my life? Where are my shadow pieces? What needs healing? Where are my strengths? What is limiting me? What is keeping me small? Where is that passion? How do I become a whole person? The more whole we are, the more we are a vessel that we can pour out in service. Because to me, the awen, the inspiration that we receive from the divine, is we're just the waylay station. We receive it, and then it's meant to be poured out in creation of something, whether it's art or music, whether it's community or healing, whether it's change or new knowledge. All of these things are meant to, they come through us. So there's that service to self that we're whole, right? And that we're growing and that we're healing and that we're clear. Because I think a lot of the stuff, the 10-minute TikTok, there's no clarity about who you are. We all have shadows, we all have wounds, we all have things about ourselves that need to be shifted and changed. And if you don't know what those are, those are going to act through you, right? What is unconscious controls us. So we need to know who we are. And then the service that we give can be pure service. It can be, without or as pure as we can, right? Because we're always growing, like you said. So, and if someone's already doing a thing, you don't need to do that thing too. You need to do your thing. Why double up on those services? So find out who you are. Pour that out in vocation. So it's service to self, service to others, to community, and then service to source, service to the divine. So being whole, being in service is a bridge to source. And all of these things are, we use the symbols of the triskel. They one flows into the other. But you need to have those three things. We have to constantly, examine ourselves and aim to grow. We need to constantly see how we can be in service to the people around us and how those things are reflections of our service to the divine, how those are actions in priest or priestessing to others.
You mentioned the Triskel, and I imagine a priestess stirring the cauldron
Stirring the
constantly,
cauldron.
like you have to do the work. You have it doesn't end, and that's why, in my opinion, Jenna, it's so important that we emphasize to young women and people that this is a call. It's a vocational initiation of sorts, whether you are in a coven or a group or a study or a self or whatever. And it's reverend, the title is such a special title, reverend, to revere the divine in your community, not to be revered,
That's right.
but to revere
That's right.
source and your community. Because what are we without our community? We're an island if we don't have, and some of us, ooh, I got goosebumps. Ooh, she like that. Oh,
Yes.
I still freak out when this happens, but when I say something that she likes,
I love that.
very intense too, from my bottom of my feet all the way to my,
No, I love that.
communities, fostering communities, plural, because what I see also with some young people on the paganism is like, I'm pagan, so I'm only having pagan friends, and my partner has to be pagan, and my children have to be pagan, and da da da. Listen, I don't have kids. You raise your children as you will. But the understanding to being an island, be living in an echo chamber, you'll drown. Have Christian friends, have pagan friends, have atheist friends, have Satanist friends, have Catholic friends, I don't know, Ifa practicing friends, or not just your church, temple, community friends, but also your neighbors, your school, HOA. I mean, I don't know,
No, it's an excellent point. It's an excellent point. And to it, I'd like to add that, community building is important. Someone has to hold that container and create the container, make sure it's safe, make sure it has the resources that it needs. Who feeds the people after the big rituals? Who ensures that the places where these things happen are compliant to people with disabilities? I mean, that is a sacred service. And the things that happen behind the scenes, the less sexy aspects of priestessing are critical. We can't have any of those things if there isn't someone who's doing the books, right? Who's filing the taxes, who's ensuring that people's needs are met, who are, making sure that, the food arrives and, cooking and, medicines and all of those things. So yes, there's so many ways of being, and the beauty of community is that you don't have to do all the things.
No.
You do what your get where your gifts are. You give from your abundance, and the other person gives from their abundance, and hopefully all of the needs are met. All of the needs are met. And one last thing I'd like to say is
Please.
this, is that becoming sovereign, right? And we define that in our tradition as being fully conscious self-determination, right? So you know yourself well enough to understand the reasons why you make the choices that you do. And you can only be conscious of that if you know yourself well enough. So
Exactly.
being sovereign in the choices that you make in the world and knowing why you make those choices is the key. But if I want to move through the world in a sovereign way, I must also honor the sovereignty of other people. I
Exactly.
can't expect them to do the things that I want them to do in the way that I want them to do. There's got to be a way, meaning of it, but that people are responsible for themselves. And I think one of the things that I like to teach in my priestessing perspective, and I do a priestessing course online, is that, let's look at the shadow aspects of leadership, of priestessing. People don't talk about that. So many people come into wanting to be in service, wanting, feeling a call to leadership, but, there's jockeying for power, and there's, competition, and, bad feelings that arise, and ego inflation. And those are real things that everyone has to move through them. But if no one's talking about them, and we've got this culture of spiritual bypassing where we're not talking about our shadow, we're not talking about any of these things, then the rot sets in. And all of these people that come to service with pure hearts can't get out of their own way because no one is saying, hey, this is a pitfall. How can we address it? And so that's part of the work that I'm trying to do. How can I empower other people to be sovereign, while also being in my sovereignty? There's ways to do that.
And I think it lies on the honesty. It is about honesty, you know. I have an anecdote, and you reminded me of that. I'm an artist as well. I create, and I, you know, do little. I create art. I'm learning not to diminish my creative side.
Good.
And I created a piece with a heart, bleeding heart, and I captioned it, "Romantic love will kill your spirit." Romantic love. This came out of me is art, and the art arted,
The art started.
and I had a lot of people. I have a few folks, well-intended, loving, telling me, "You're a priestess. You shouldn't be this and that about that art piece." And my response to them was, "The art arted. It you had a reaction, and that's what art is for. What within you creates this reaction? I'm saying something that I feel because 9 women get murdered for being women in Mexico, just for being women." Don't you fool yourself that United States is so far behind.
No.
5 women get murdered in the United States for being women.
Every day.
And somebody asked me, "Who is kill but who is killing them?" And I'm like, "Men." You know, this person was trying to find out, like, whom, from which ethnic, demographic, age. Men. It's men.
All.
It's men, you know. But anywho, the multi-dimensional aspect of a priestess, you know, I'm a priestess, I connect with the divine, but I'm on this earth knowing that 9 women of my ethnicity in our homeland get murdered a day. So I'm going to express that artistically in a way that I see fit. And if you think a priestess cannot speak about this political issue, then you haven't understood, in my opinion, what the priestess work is. You know, I cannot just sit and sing Kumbaya. Nothing wrong with singing Kumbaya, but you know. And also, you reminded me with the different aspects of being a priestess, of the different aspects of being an activist. You have And they call us keyboard warriors as if it was a bad thing. We are
Some
needed.
people, that's what they can do.
We need to share where the people are going to get together and when the protest is going to
Right,
happen, and
right.
we are the ones making the flyers. And you know, so you have your keyboard warriors, and then you have the people who feed us, and then you have the people who pray for us, and then you have the people on the front line with the bikes pushing
That's right.
against the oppressors. And then you have the people at the center screaming Black Lives Matter, you
You
know.
have the lawyers that get people out of jail. Then you have the lobbyists that try to affect change in the system. Yes, we need all of those, all of those, all of those
And
pieces.
not something I researched because I taught a class on activism, paganism, and cynicism. Cynicism is that 75% of the work of activism happen not marching, and only 25% of the activism work is marching on the streets. Some people don't have the luxury to be able to get arrested.
That's right. That's right.
Some people are disabled, and they contribute as much as they
In
get.
ways that they can.
I am having the time of my life having this conversation with you. We are almost at the top of the hour, and I cannot let you go without speaking. Another silly question: where can people get this wonderful book?
You can get
And
it everywhere. It's on all of the places. Please do support small businesses, local bookstores. If you have to purchase online, go to bookstore.org. There's a link on my website that lists all my books, and all of the monies it comes to a it come all the books come from small independent bookstores, and they'll sell it to you. So it's just like buying on Amazon, and there are sales and things like that. So you can get it everywhere. But yeah, try to support pagan
for your
businesses, women's
locals.
businesses, Black-owned businesses, all the businesses. That is not the corporate overlord businesses.
And if you must buy from big box online, whatever, write a review. Don't do like Laura, who thought she needed to write an essay. No, you can buy the book and then you can say, hey, I bought the book. I love it. The author is fantastic. And that's that.
That is appreciated. And you don't even have to buy a book on the Evil A place to leave a review there. So
Oh, you can
just
just go
there.
and do a review. I didn't know that.
You can, they'll say, a verified purchase if you bought it on Amazon, but you can also leave if you haven't
Oh, I didn't know
purchased it
that.
there.
So that is great news to have on Amazon reviews. And then there is another one, the Goodreads.
Goodreads. Yeah.
Goodreads helps the authors a great deal.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. And I think we had planned to talk about International Women's Day. It's implied.
It's implied.
If you didn't find it, go listen again because it is implied on everything that we said. March 11th, can you believe it? Do you have any plans after tonight? Where are you going? What are you presenting? What are you teaching? What's going on?
Yeah, there's a lot of things. Since COVID, things have opened up a lot. So, last year I started going back to in-person events. I'll be at Sacred Space Conference in Maryland at the end of March. The Sisterhood of Avalon, we have our 10th annual Avicon, which is an online conference. And that's the first weekend, I believe, in April. And that's a pay as you want. So, any donation is welcome. It's a fundraiser. We also, because we're so centered in, being in the culture and immersing in the sacred landscape, we host annual trips to sites in Wales and in other places in the UK. And so we have one this summer. We're going to places associated with the goddesses of the Mabinogi, and we're being in Wales, and we're being hosted for a few days on Anglesey, which is the seat of Druidism in Britain. And oh, the cats, I'm sorry. And we're going to be with Christopher Hughes and members of the Anglesey Druid Order, which I'm studying with to become a Druid with them as well. So there are a couple of spots left. I think there are only three or four left. So check that out if you feel drawn to join us. I know pilgrimage isn't something everyone can do, but if you can, it's a lasting connection that goes further than just that time. And yeah, there's so much, oh gosh, there's so much online stuff that's really accessible. So I would say go to my website, and it is InnisAvalon.com, which means the island of Avalon in Welsh, or my name, JennaTellandrew.com. I'm sure Laura will put all the things somewhere where this video or audio will live, so you can find it, YNYSAFALLON.com. And yeah, so thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Of course. Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to CSNP, the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast, from which I'm very, very proud and honored to be the manager. And my job is to remind you to listen to Circle Talk 2 Tuesdays a month with Deborah Rose. Circle of Nature one Wednesday a month with the Selena Fox, Blue Marble with Charlotte Bear on the third Friday of the month, Songs of the Pagan Tribe, second and fourth Friday of the month with Karen Green, and Paganos del Mundo, which means Pagans of the World, or Pagados del Mundo in Portuguese, our podcast that is multilingual on Spanish and Portuguese with various hosts: Christian Ortiz, Carolina Moore, Monica Gowin, Harwet Tuileva, Patricia Finkler, and yours truly in Espanol. And of course, Lunatic Mondays, two Mondays a month. We have, Jenna, over 1,000 hours of podcasts
Wow.
that we do because we love you. We don't get a cent, literally. We get this enriching, wonderful connections. Well, myself, I'm very proud to get to know my guests here in this chatting room.
Same.
And go and listen. You can listen, you can download, you can share, you can keep for your archives, and they are invaluable. I mean, Selena Fox, right? And the whole
What can
team,
you
right?
say about Selena Fox?
Selena is fantastic. And of course, if you want to follow me and support me, you can find me as Magia Cerati, MagiaCerati on Instagram. You can find my link tree as Magia Cerati. You can find me on Facebook, Esther by Laura Gonzalez, Blue Witch. I'm all over the place. I'm teaching classes online. I'm teaching courses online. I'm doing women's circles online and in person. Because we need the goddess. Do we need the goddess to be everywhere? So we're also doing this, the Colonizing the Goddess course. If you missed the first three, they're available on demand. You can purchase the classes. Very affordable because I don't want to charge $80 per class. You know, they're even half of that. And support your local priestesses and witches and mentors and teachers and all of that. And Jenna, all I have to say is thank you so much for enriching this space with your wit and your wisdom and your love for the goddess. And
Thank you so much for having me and for all of the beautiful work that you do. I'm touched to be here with you. Thank you.
thank you. And to all our listeners, and in this case, you know, I took a shower, so we have a video as well. If you want to see us doing faces, come to YouTube to watch it. My YouTube is also Tarot by Laura, and that's where they live. When the podcast produce a video, they live on my YouTube. So to all of you, thank you all for watching, for listening, and for existing, for seeing the goddess in you. And until we meet again, never forget that you are loved. Bye-bye. Lunatic Mondays is a production of Laura Gonzalez for CSN Podcasts, building bridges of community around the world.
Thank you for joining us on the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow nature-centered paths. Join us throughout the week for various programming connecting with the community around the world. Please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSN Podcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. Until next time, many blessings.